Now, over recent weeks, we've been dropping in and catching up with Paul Quigley. Now, Paul Quigley is living with retinitis pigmentosa, has lost all of his sight now, but has a very keen interest in music, was aligned with a rather major rock band back in the day, and still involved with music, aren't you, Paul?
I am indeed. Thank you for having me, Simon. Thank you.
No, you're welcome. And the reason we're chatting about this, because you were in a heavy metal band and you're multi-instrumentalist, but this is an acoustic album you're doing, isn't it?
It is indeed. It's my first, well, I suppose you'd call it solo album. And I decided that rather than be electric, this one should be acoustic because I have a huge love of traditional British, well, Irish, Scottish, English folk music and my own compositions. And I wanted to blend them all together and put all the electrical instruments down and switch the amps off and pick up an acoustic and a Spanish guitar, if you like, and a bit of acoustic piano and do that. So, yeah, you know, songs from the heart, really. That's what it's about, Simon.
But do you not find, even though we say, right, we're going to do this, strip this back, we'll do it simply, you bring sight loss into this, there isn't such a thing as simple, is there? There's some amount of technology you have to use at some point along the way.
Yes, there is. I mean, if it's as simple as, you know, everyone thinks you just have to string up your own guitar. And even that could be a challenge when you can't see when what you're doing with where the string's going to go through the machine heads, as you know, on a guitar. So, yeah, it's very, very fundamental when you've lost it. Everything is by touch after that. And obviously sound becomes incredibly important. Being as musicians, we'd know that. But, yeah, the practicalities of recording are huge. And the, you know, it is expensive. Of course, one could hire a studio and get somebody else to do it, but that cost consume amount, and of course when budgets are limited, as they are for everybody, it's not an option. So with technology being so cheap these days, well, cheaper, certainly cheaper than it used to be, it's a lot more practical to consider using your own tech by buying your own bits of work, and that's the route I've gone.
So is this going to be a recorded album, or are you recording live tracks?
Good question. It's actually both, really, because I think the best recordings are the ones where you do rehearse yourself really, really well. So you know your piece as if you were going to perform it live, but then you just literally hit the record button and grab as close a take, almost like a one take, for the whole of the song as you possibly can. Because once you begin, I found in my experience anyway, once you start dropping in, as they call it, where you'll do a line and then you make a mistake on, say, the line or second, third line, and then think, oh, I'll drop, I can always, you know, recap that one. Once you start dropping in, you're comping, what they call comping, and that is where you almost create an artificial song. You would never be able to replicate it live, and it tends to have a certain amount of clipping and curtness to it, and it doesn't flow anymore. You lose a certain cadence. So I don't do that. I don't multi-track where you can literally hit pause or rewind and record again. You can do that, and a lot of people do that for complex synth bands and stuff. You have to do it that way with drum machines and other, you know, obviously orchestras and stuff. But for solo, I think it's best to try and keep it simple, even the recording stage where you could multi-track and have loads of extra instruments. I've done that before, where you put loads of strings down and stuff. But it's like throwing stuff in a melting pot when you're cooking. You can put sometimes too many ingredients in it. You need to start removing stuff out of the mix. So for me, it is as close to the recording of a live performance that I try to do, because then I think once I take it on the road, that's what it's going to be like anyway, or, you know, bar the old drum machine or something here and there. So I think, you know, the best musicians are the ones that can just pull it off, literally just pick up their instrument and do it like you would in the corner of a club or a pub. You know, if you can do it live, you can do it anywhere. So that's my view on recording anyways, that it's got to be organic and it's got to capture an emotion. And sometimes when you over egg it with technology, you can actually kill the emotion, and I want to avoid that. And as you know, when you get in a studio, once you become, you almost get blinkered, literally, and you can get sort of cabin fever where you get so insulated in what you're doing, and you can actually lose touch with the song that you're doing. So you can overdo it with compression and EQing and everything like that, and all the tech stuff that all the engineers out there will know about. But for the end user, the actual listener, they don't care. They don't care about compression, and if it sounds good, it is good, and that can often mean you just throw up a couple of mics, you know, set your levels, and away you go and capture the emotion. And that's the way I'm going to do this album.
Well, do you know, I'm a lot of the same kind of thinking, but I don't like recording in studios unless it's recording as live. But I would much rather record as live. And for, like, a case in point, a couple of videos were taken of the band I play in a few weeks ago, and none of us knew they were being taken. And they were taken professionally. And it was great. So it captured two tracks yeah. and a moment of the band that are not playing to a camera. You're just doing yeah. what you do, which is make music.
Yeah, it's like a fly on the wall documentary of what it's actually like. And I think that's what recorded music should be like. And I think actually I was watching a documentary about the Beatles the other day, and listening to it on YouTube, and it was describing how they'd set up in Abbey Road and set up the drums and the amps and everything. And literally they set up, even though they could have set up in separate booths and separated all the channels, they didn't. They actually still performed right up to the album called Abbey Road in 1970. They still recorded as a band, which they had done since, you know, Hamburg back in 58-60. So they still, obviously, they needed that where they feed off of each other's personalities, even if they well rehearsed a song, whether it's Come Together or Let It Be, or certainly not Let It Be. That was not on that album. But I mean, the thing is they actually still recorded as a band, and there was actually bleed through from one track to another, where you could hear the drums in the bass mics, you could hear the bass guitar, McCartney's bass in the drum mics and everything. So it was fascinating how even they, who could probably have afforded the best studio in the world, which was EMI Studios in Abbey Road at the time anyway, so they were in the best studio, but they recorded organically. They didn't get tempted to go 8-track, because it was only 8-track in them days, four-track, 8-track, hadn't gone to 16 or 24 back in 1970, but it later did. And I think that's where a lot of bands fall foul, even apart from Pink Floyd, who spent 6 months in the studio, is that they overtrack. You know, you overtrack. And of course, then you take it live. How do you do that? How could you need a huge mixing desk live, you know, 24, 48 track mixing console? And of course, then you're running click track on Simpty tape and everything like that. And you work it, and you lose that organicness, and you're rigidly fixed into a schedule, if you like, through the whole set gets programmed. How can you possibly be organic and spontaneous and from the heart? So I would avoid that at all costs. And obviously that's the, you know, if you're all synthed up and everything, you have to do that to some extent. But, you know, for bands that's small, you know, up to 4-piece, 5-piece or whatever, I really do think that, as you've said, what you were saying, you rehearse and rehearse so that you get great little combo sound. And same for acoustic solo performers like myself at the moment. You know, we have to know our songs inside out, back to front. Then they start to breathe and have a life of their own. That's the way I'm going to record it. I'm always going to record it, you know.
So which instruments are you playing on this album then?
Well, I play all of them, even programming drum machines, but I can actually play the drum kit if I needed to. I've gotten like one of those electronic kits that you plug in through MIDI, which anyone who knows, it's a musical instrument digital interface which triggers sample sounds, and you can hit drum pads. So I can do that, but I'm obviously guitar. I've done since I was about 12, 13, 14, so I can do the 6-string bass as well. Didn't move to bass when I was 14, played bass for years. So I know I underpin a track as well with the bass lines, and then sing and play the piano. I taught myself keys in more recent years, just for basically like an Elton John sort of way of playing, you know, chords and stuff. But it just fills it out. And I think, you know, a certain amount of music theory helps a lot, particularly for composition. I find that I'm very grateful in a way that I did learn trumpet when I was 12 at school, because I did have to learn all of the dots if they got, but I can't see them now. I haven't been able to see scores for years, but the point is, in my mind's eye, I can still see them. And I know which chord structures are relative to each other, so, you know, relative majors and minors. I know all of that, fortunately. So when I'm actually writing a song, I have in the back of my mind, as I said to someone recently, a very sort of fundamental idea of which chord progressions would work with others and tempos and stuff. And it helps, you know, because then you don't need to rely on sort of a proper musician when come the time when you need to go into a studio of some sort to put it down, you know, in a structured way, which you have to. You can do pretty much all of it yourself. And I think that's the key to be a proper musician, is you are as self-contained as you possibly can be, like all the greats were indeed. I mean, I can't think of any greats other than straight vocalists, maybe like Frank Sinatra, who was a great vocalist, but I don't know if he was so good on music theory. And of course he had a band leader like Tommy Dorsey who he'd rely on. So I mean, it's a huge amount of, you know, can teamwork and partners work really well. But as much as anything else, whether you're Benny and Bjorn or Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber, you have to bring something to the party and be able to sort of work as much as you can where you're a self-contained unit. And of course, as a solo performer, you have to be a all singing, all dancing jack of all trades, master of none. But you know what I mean? I mean, you'll try to be as good as you possibly can be, and hopefully that the actual aggregate output, that what you come out is worthy. It is a bit of musical art, I suppose you'd call it, and hopefully it stands alone. And if it's done with integrity, of course it will be, you know.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I don't read music anymore. I haven't done since I was probably about 20, and I was never proficient about music, because at that time all I wanted to do was play music, and I thought this kind of stuff's slowing me down. And so I think you have limitations when you don't know all that structural stuff like I don't. But on the other hand, it's forced me always to be creative. You do the similar stuff we're expected to do it. But on solos, depending on how I'm feeling, sometimes I do something completely different and it keeps it alive.
It can do. Well, I think the thing is about solos where you go, you extemporize. It's almost like jazz, as you were saying that. The great thing about that is that you know roughly which patterns you can go in. Because if you stick a wrong note in a wrong scale, of course, it sticks out like a sore thumb and you think, oh, no. Yeah, you can just feel it. I mean, you don't have to be a musician to know that that was a wrong note. It just doesn't fit in the scale, whether it's a harmonic major or a major or a minor scale. It just doesn't work. And again, you can sometimes get out of it quite easily by just going onto a riff or whatever that does work. But a lot of it is by feel. I mean, I guess there are a lot of players out there, like you were saying, who know the feel of a scale rather than knowing the exact note, you know, the names and the flats and the sharps of a note that when they're in the scale playing it live. And of course, yeah, who would want to be so ring-fenced into a scale that you're literally going up and down scales or whatever, almost like a machine. I mean, yeah, a machine can do that. And in some ways, happy accidents and bum notes are often quite humanizing. They actually make the audience think, yeah, I'm listening to a real human being who's doing something right, you know, almost going off the wall, jumping off the deep end, just and seeing where they go. And I think that's good. You know, there's definitely some, you know, value in that, rather than somebody who's so well rehearsed that it's note perfect, then they might as well just put the CD on in the car. You know, it's, yeah, there is that as well. So I think it's a balance. It's a very fine edge, isn't it, between making a balls up of a note, so to speak, or a solo, or one that sort of you can tell that, yeah, this musician's just gone, you know, they've gone for it and it didn't quite work, but you know what, it doesn't matter, because overall there was an emotion, there was it was an experience that they were sharing, and I think that's what music should be. It's, if it's all about too structured, you know, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, Beethoven, that can be a little bit tedious because there's no scope, then there's no human element to it. So I think you're right. So it's a fine line.
Well, Mr. Quigley, we will keep getting updates on the album, but thanks very much for chatting with us. Well, you got any kind of timeline for this when you're going to have it finished, do you think?
I think some of the people who have been following me have been very patient. The album coming soon for quite a long time. So I would like to get it out now over the summer. So I think by the end of the summer, I think I've got to have it up on iTunes, Spotify. And if you want to tune in, find me on Twitter, hellsbells_UK, Paul Quigley UK on Facebook, and all good record shops if they still exist, Simon.
Paul, always a pleasure. We'll catch up with you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Simon. Thank you very much.